You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, federal lawmakers have passed competing bills to address the humanitarian crisis at the southern border. We'll look at the details in just a bit.
First, Republicans in the state legislature sent a budget plan to Governor Evers yesterday after the bill was passed. After the bill was passed on a 17-16 vote, Evers can now sign the bill, veto it entirely, or strike down certain parts of the plan.
The bill cut back or removed many of the governor's big budget proposals, including a gas tax increase, a nonpartisan redistricting commission, and taking federal funds to expand Wisconsin's Badger Care program.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So as we mentioned, this was 17-16, a pretty tight vote in the Senate with two Republicans voting against the bill. What allowed leadership to get other potential holdouts on board and get this passed?
Well, there were a couple changes in the assembly on Tuesday that kind of cleared the path a little bit for the Senate, kind of angled at some of the Republican senators that they weren't sure were going to be on board. Those changes that passed the assembly, one was a study related to mileage-based fees in Wisconsin for road projects, to fund road projects. They made a little tweak there to add tolling to that study language, so that would kind of open up tolling potentially for the future. And then there was another change aimed at a new state senator. He used to be in the assembly, Senator Andre Jacques. They added 35 assistant district attorney positions to the budget. That's something he's pushed for. And then one other element that got a little bit more coverage related to Teslas. It would allow Teslas to be sold directly to consumers in Wisconsin without car dealerships being involved.
Can we take a little bit of a deep dive into that? Because that proved to be a really interesting part of this process. Senator Chris Kapinga was one of the people that has been pushing for direct sales of Tesla cars to be allowed in the state before. It is pretty known that he owns a business that sells Tesla parts. How has he responded to people who have accused him of basically potentially benefiting from this?
He pushed back pretty hard on that yesterday. So he said that it's really sort of a half-truth was the phrase that he used in regards to him profiting from this Tesla language that's in the budget. He said that his business is really more of a hobby. He got involved in getting Tesla cars and kind of breaking them down for parts and rebuilding them a few years ago. He sells the parts that he doesn't need online, he says, and not for much of a profit. As of yesterday, we took a look at his site, which is he links to eBay to sell these parts, and he had things ranging from, you know, $25 to $1,200. But he says when you factor in the amount of time he's putting in and what he pays for the cars to begin with, it's really kind of a loss for him in the end.
Is there going to be any, insofar as you know, any pushback moving forward with this, or is this a one and done with Senator Kapinga moving forward?
Well, there has certainly been some concern raised by folks who believe that it was kind of a trade in terms of getting him to vote for the budget, putting this thing in there where there's the appearance of him personally benefiting. And that's something that, you know, maybe Governor Evers will weigh as he moves forward. He has the budget before him or will very soon officially. So the governor can always make changes, but as of right now, you know, this is outside the legislature's hands, so it's going to stay in there for now.
Republican Senators Steve Noss and David Craig both voted against the bill. What ultimately were their objections?
So they were pretty consistent. The two had a similar argument that they believed it was just too big of a budget, a little too expensive. They were concerned about the fee increases for vehicle title and registration that are included in the budget, as well as property tax increases that are included in the budget. These are two senators that have been pretty consistent in their pushback during the state budget process. They're two of the four that held up budget negotiations 2 years ago, and they had similar concerns then.
We're talking to Laurel White right now. She is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. She's with us to talk about the state budget that passed yesterday. And let's take a listen really quickly to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald offering his take on the budget bill that passed yesterday.
We've taken the parameters given to us by the governor and turned his out-of-control spending plan into a responsible budget for Wisconsin. We're borrowing $500 million less than the governor, taxing $1 billion less than the governor, and spending $2 billion less than Governor Evers.
Cost was always a big part of the Republicans' pushback against the budget that they originally got. How are they talking now about the budget that they then sent back to the governor?
So they're really saying that it's a responsible middle ground between what the governor wanted, what he originally introduced earlier this year, and their conservative principles. I think, you know, the way that they're framing it is we've given the governor things that he asked for, but a little bit more, in their opinion, within reason. They have scaled back a number of the governor's proposals, but still included increases for certain things, like K-12 education, for example. They put a $500 million increase in there under the Republican plan. Now, that's substantially smaller than what the governor asked for. He wanted $1.4 billion. And I think that's a pretty good example, just sort of you can draw that across the whole swath of the state budget as a way to sort of say this is what Republicans did in terms of what the governor proposed.
And what was some of the reactions from the Democrats in the legislature to the budget plan that was ultimately sent to the governor yesterday?
So Democrats are really framing this, I think, in two ways. One, they are pretty focused on the things that Republican lawmakers removed from the budget, particularly the Medicaid expansion. That's something that Governor Evers campaigned on. It's something he's spoken about really consistently throughout this budget process, something that he said would save the state $320 million, would bring 82,000 more people onto Badger Care in Wisconsin, leverage more than $1 billion of federal money by his calculations. And Democrats were very consistent in pointing that out, saying it's something the state needed to do, saying it was irresponsible for Republican lawmakers to not do that. So there were certainly those concerns, and they continue to voice those. I think the other way that Democrats are framing the budget, though, interestingly, is saying Governor Evers proposed a plan that had a lot of great things in it, and because he proposed what he did, he moved the needle a little bit for Republicans. So Democrats are saying that Republicans are doing a little bit more than they have in the past, more than recent years, because of the ambitious, wide-ranging budget that the governor put out there.
So it sounds like some of our Democratic lawmakers are looking for a silver lining here in what has been a somewhat contentious budget debate, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is a new process for Wisconsin, or at least, you know, in terms of the last several years, there's been one party in control in the legislature and the governor's office. So this is a little bit of new territory for some lawmakers, having a different party in the executive branch and navigating how they're going to handle that sort of walking the line of compromise, but still getting the votes that they need to pass it through the Republican-controlled legislature.
We're talking with Laurel White right now. She is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter, and she's with us to talk about the budget plan that was passed yesterday that's now headed to Governor Evers' desk.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the Republican-backed budget that passed yesterday? What issues are important in your part of the state? Is it transportation, education, healthcare, or something else? What do you think Governor Evers should do with the plan now? And if you're a Democrat, would you like to see some vetoes? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue this conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're talking about the state budget bill passed by the state legislature yesterday and what happens now. We're joined by WPR's state capitol reporter, Laurel White.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you're a Democrat, what are some of your thoughts on the budget plan that ultimately is heading to the governor's desk? If you're a Republican, are you happy with the budget? What do you think Governor Evers will do? And if you're a Democrat, also, Are you thinking that the governor might veto parts of it? And you can also let us know what budget issues are most important to you so far in the state. Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And Laurel, right before we went to the break, we started talking a little bit about some of the stuff that ended up on the chopping block. And one of the big contentious issues has been transportation funding. We haven't been able to move the needle too much. Governor Evers originally called for a gas tax increase to pay for road projects. What are we going to actually end up seeing in terms of transportation funding?
So Republicans actually came up with a plan that introduces more new revenue into the state transportation budget than we've had for quite a while. And they're going to do that by raising vehicle title and registration fees. So the fee that you pay the state when you buy a new car or the annual fee that you pay to renew your license. That's going to generate about $393 million in new revenue for the state. So that's something that we have heard positive comments made about from the state transportation secretary, for example. I think this is something that lawmakers and the governor have been pushing for in terms of, you know, getting a little bit more funding in there to do some of these projects. That is, of course, though, different from what the governor proposed, right? As we've talked about, the governor wanted an 8-cent gas tax increase in this budget, which would have generated even more than the $393 million. But ultimately, Republican lawmakers just didn't have the votes to do that for a variety of reasons.
I want to really quickly go to our callers right now. We have Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, what did you want to say about the budget?
Well, the very issue that you're discussing right now is the issue that bothers me the most. I live in Milwaukee, and here in this city, we already are paying an additional $10 extra added to the $75 that the state has been asking. So for that to be raised still another $10, and this exorbitant fee, all of these fees just to drive, own, and license a car, I am very angry about this.
Nancy, thank you so much for that call. You know, we're hearing some anger from Nancy about this fee increase. And one of the arguments that Governor Evers made for the gas tax was that it would be more spread out. It would impact people traveling through the state from, say, Illinois. Why ultimately wasn't the sort of shared burden enough of, a push to get Republicans on board with this?
Well, you know, Republicans kind of went back and revisited an argument that we've heard kind of consistently, I think it's safe to say, over this transportation funding debate, which is that the gas tax might not be the most sustainable solution in terms of road funding for Wisconsin. They said that people are moving more toward hybrid and electric vehicles. So down the line, fewer gas purchases in the state will not be providing enough revenue for ongoing projects. So that argument that certainly we have heard from proponents of the gas tax, which is that people from Minnesota and Illinois and others driving through the state use the roads, so they should help maintain the roads, just wasn't compelling enough to get Republicans that control the Assembly and the Senate to pass that increase.
You know, listening to, I'm going to throw this to an odd place, but to the Democratic debates last night, healthcare was one of the biggest topics, and it's been a big issue here in Wisconsin. And we talked a little bit about the fact that the Republicans were not necessarily on board with expanding Medicaid. That's been pretty consistent for the last 8+ years. Why didn't we see, did we see any compromise here in terms of either Medicaid, healthcare coverage in the state, or was this sort of dead in the water?
There was a little bit of compromise. I think, you know, the big overarching thing, the Medicaid expansion, obviously didn't happen in this budget. That's something that Wisconsin Republicans have been opposed to for quite a while now, and they weren't willing to move on that at all. I think Speaker Voss at one point during the budget negotiations said that it would be over his dead body that the Medicaid expansion would be approved. So that certainly didn't happen, but there were elements of Medicaid reimbursements, increases for things like nursing homes, for example, or personal care workers that the governor wanted to put in the budget to increase state support for those things. And Republican lawmakers met him there and actually, in some cases, went a little bit further in the case of both of those things, actually, nursing homes and personal care workers, and put more state money into augmenting those funds than even the governor asked for.
The Republican budget plan, we also mentioned a little bit about education, has $500 million in new state funding for K through 12 education. We know that Governor Evers was looking for more. Public opinion seemed to want more money. Is this just the first step towards a more robust education system, or are we still going to be fighting about this throughout the rest of Governor Evers' term?
I don't think this is an issue that's going to go away, certainly. Obviously, Governor Evers has a strong background in education, serving as the former state school superintendent. This was a really big issue for him in his campaign. You know, he talked a lot about healthcare, roads, and schools. So the education budget that he proposed was a rather large one. He wanted a $1.4 billion increase. He only got $500 million from Republican lawmakers. He wanted $600 million for special education programs in terms of an increase, got about $100 million from Republicans. What Republicans are saying in response to the governor and Democrats saying, you know, you didn't meet the governor on this, is that they believe this investment is still very sizable, it's substantial, it's going to make a difference for Wisconsin schools. And they also point out that this comes on the heels of another pretty substantial increase in the last state budget, which had a $636 million increase for K-12 education.
We've been talking about the legislature itself, but now our attention needs to turn to Governor Evers, who has the option to veto all of the budget or certain parts of the budget. Here's Democratic Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling telling Republicans what she's hoping for.
I am asking the governor to throw you guys a brush back pitch on this budget. You need that. We will see how aggressive he uses that veto pen.
Some anger coming from Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling there in response to the budget that they ultimately voted on. You know, being up at the Capitol, has Evers given any indication whatsoever about what he plans to do next?
He really hasn't. You know, obviously, reporters have been asking the governor for a while what he plans to do with this budget. And pretty consistently, he's said, you know, I'm going to review it when it gets to my desk. We don't know what changes lawmakers are going to make as the process unfolds. Well, now obviously he knows, right? It's passed as of yesterday. He has a pretty solid idea what the document looks like. He tweeted this morning that he is ready for the budget, which is a strong signal. It's interesting. So the way the process works is, now that it's passed both bodies, it has to get some official signatures, and it's enrolled, is what they call it, and then it gets sent to the governor, and that's when he can begin the official review. He tweeted this morning that he's ready for that official process to start, for that budget to get to his desk. So he knows what he's going to do, but we don't know what that is yet.
And what is the timeline? It's heading to him now. We know he's going to review it. When is his due date, I guess?
Mm-hmm. So he has 6 days. Once he gets that official document on his desk, 6 days, not including Sundays, to act on it. So I believe we are expecting the assembly leader to sign the budget tomorrow. He's out of town today, actually touring around the state promoting the budget. So he'll be back. He'll sign it, send it to the governor tomorrow. And if my calculations are correct, that means the governor has until next Friday to act on the bill.
You know, are we seeing Republicans considering this a win? Are Democrats more fired up? What is the temperature up at the Capitol right now?
I think Republicans, you know, I mentioned the speakers traveling the state promoting the budget today. The Senate Majority Leader had a press conference in the Capitol today as well. They're really framing this as a win for everybody. They're saying that Republicans met a lot of the goals that they laid out for the budget, that it's a people's budget, that it's responsive to what Wisconsin voters want. So I think Republicans are very solidly in the this is a win camp. And as I mentioned before, there's an element of that to the Democratic rhetoric as well. They're saying that because of what the governor proposed, it sort of moved the needle a little bit and pushed Republicans to put maybe a little bit more money into some programs than they would have if there wasn't a Democrat in the governor's office. So though Democrats are a little bit obviously concerned about some things that aren't in there, like the Medicaid expansion, there is positive rhetoric about this budget on both sides.
Looking in the very short term, what will you be on the lookout for, I guess, over the next 6 days? And then if we see some fireworks after day six, what happens then?
Well, we're definitely going to be keeping an eye out. It could happen at any point. With the governor signaling today that he's ready for the budget, I would expect him to act kind of sooner in that six-day window rather than later. So we might not have to wait too long to see what he's going to do with this budget. The most, challenging thing for lawmakers that he could do, obviously, is veto the entire thing, mm-hmm. which sort of starts the process back over. I think that would be the biggest firework you could get. So if that happens, we're in for probably several weeks, if not months, of negotiations starting over. If that doesn't happen, it's sure that the governor is going to have some vetoes using his veto pen to take out words and numbers. The Wisconsin governor's veto pen is pretty powerful, yeah. So he can make a lot of changes there.
Yeah, we learned a little bit about that partial veto power yesterday. You know, in the last 45 seconds that we've got left, once the budget process does wrap up, we're expecting the legislature to come back in session this fall. What do you think that they will make one of their big priorities?
Well, there were a number of things, as you mentioned before, that were removed from the budget, and lawmakers have talked about those things coming back in the fall. Their schedule is set to begin again kind of in mid-September. The things that are on my radar are the dark store loophole.
Yeah.
People have talked about that, medical marijuana possibly coming back, and nonpartisan redistricting. Those are all on the radar.
Laurel, thank you so much for that update.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She was with us to talk about the budget plan that passed in the state legislature yesterday. Governor Evers now has 6 days to either sign the bill or use his veto powers. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
The U.S. Supreme Court has decided a pair of cases challenging partisan gerrymandering that have big implications for Wisconsin.
In a 5-4 ruling, the court decided to uphold maps that were challenged for being too partisan and favoring one party over the other. In the majority decision, justices argued the issue was not one the courts should weigh in on.
J.R. Ross is the editor of WisPolitics, and he joins us now to talk about what the ruling means for Wisconsin. J.R., welcome back to the show.
How are you doing today?
Good. Well, start by telling us a little bit more about what the majority decided today.
Essentially, the majority is saying there is no place for the courts, federal courts, to step in and say that map drawn by that legislature is too partisan to stand the constitutional muster. It basically leaves it all to lawmakers and governors in these states to draw these maps, except for those that have like a independent commission, and just says the courts have no role in doing this. Now, to critics, that means you're opening the door to the most extreme partisan gerrymanders that these guys can think up, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, because they now have carte blanche to act without any worries about the court stepping in and saying, no, that's one step too far.
So we had that prominent Wisconsin lawsuit up against the Supreme Court. At this point, with this ruling, there's no other legal recourse at this point, is there?
No, and I talked to the attorney for those who had filed the lawsuit today. He said he'd been contacted by the attorneys for the Republican lawmakers about basically filing a joint motion to dismiss the suit, which he was going through all the 36 plaintiffs to make sure they're okay with that, because the reality is there's no place for this decision to go. There was a trial scheduled for July on the Wisconsin case only if the Supreme Court kept the door open for these kind of challenges. Now that door's been closed, what would you argue? It's basically the exact same argument we saw in the Maryland and North Carolina cases the court ruled on today, and that is the plaintiffs had argued in the Wisconsin case they have this new standard. They have a way to measure a partisan gerrymander that they said could be used by courts, but the court today in D.C. said no, that there's just no standard we can use that we're comfortable with.
So for advocates who wanted to see a change, who really wanted to see the Supreme Court do something about this, what options do they have at this point?
Well, in other states, you know, they've gone to referendums to create new independent commissions. You know, we don't have that option in Wisconsin. So your option, if you're a Democrat or somebody looking to change this, is to win more elections. Well, the problem for Democrats is they have a map in their minds that's stacked against them. So what do you do? Well, we will have a new map drawn after the 2020 census. That'll take place sometime in 2021. What's going to be different from last time is that the court's probably going to draw it. Now, I mean, there is a small, and I mean small, chance that Republican lawmakers and Governor Tony Evers can agree on a map, but I don't see that happening, neither anybody else I talked to. So in years past, we've had split control of government. The courts have drawn the maps. So what's going to be interesting to watch in 2021 is, will it be our state Supreme Court, which is going to have a conservative majority in 2021, or will it be the federal courts, where we've already seen a three-judge panel in Wisconsin, you know, overturn the assembly lines were drawn last time. So that's what to watch. What court decides the map in 2021, again, barring the minor miracle of Republican lawmakers and the Democratic governor agreeing on new lines?
And briefly, JR, as we wrap up, what kind of reaction have you heard from officials and policymakers from around the state to today's decision?
Oh, Republicans are hailing this as, you know, that this whole lawsuit has been a waste of taxpayer resources and this upholds the maps that they, like they knew it the entire time. Dems have bemoaned that this is a kind of a knock for democracy in general. It's going to make it harder because now you're having lawmakers pick who they represent versus voters picking who represents them. So, you know, it's the stuff we've heard before, but this is definitely a blow for Democrats in Wisconsin who are hoping for new maps in 2020 to have a better shot of picking up seats in legislature.
Well, JR, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Take care.
That was J.R. Ross of the website WIS Politics. He was with us to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court decision this morning, ruling 5-4 against opponents of partisan gerrymandering and effectively ending legal challenges to district maps, like the one in Wisconsin, on those grounds. We'll have more analysis of this decision and more tomorrow at 3:30.
Moving on, after some twists and turns this week, Congress has passed a humanitarian aid package to deal with the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Both the House and Senate had passed plans earlier this week to spend about the same amount of money, but the initial House version had some more limits on how it could be used, along with some policy changes. Now, after pressure from moderate House Democrats, they've passed the Senate's version of the plan.
The issue picked up urgency this week with an Associated Press photo. It shows the bodies of a man, Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez, and his 23-month-old daughter, Valeria, who drowned in the Rio Grande trying to enter the U.S.
Yesterday, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who chairs the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, said the time to act is now.
I realize tragedies occur all over this country, all over the world. I don't want to see another picture like that on the U.S. border. I hope that picture alone will catalyze this Congress, this Senate, this committee to do something.
Abigail Hausloner joins us now to talk about this story. She's an immigration reporter with The Washington Post. Abigail, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So it's been kind of a wild week in Congress with this story. Bring us to the latest news with what happened today. House Democrats voting in favor of supporting that Senate plan. What happened today?
Well, as you mentioned, the House passed essentially the same bill as the Senate had already passed yesterday. It's a $4.6 billion spending package, and it will basically pour all these funds into these Department of Homeland Security and Department of Health and Human Services agencies that are dealing with this crisis on the border. And they did it to essentially, you know, try to alleviate what these agencies are saying is a major crisis, that they're at capacity, that they cannot deal with the influx of the almost unprecedented influx of families and children, largely from Central America, who are coming across and are being apprehended. And, you know, as you mentioned, this was sort of all over the place this week. That's because the Senate passed a bill, a bipartisan bill that, you know, the White House supported to push all this cash into these agencies. And the House Democrats really wanted to insert a bunch of provisions into the bill that would basically try to set up more protections for migrant children in custody and bring a little more accountability, in their view, to these agencies who are detaining them. The House did pass that bill narrowly. It was largely along party lines. And then they scrapped it today to pass the Senate bill in order, how Democratic moderates said to, just get those funds out there. And there were a lot of liberals, obviously, who were not pleased with that.
How much pressure was there on Congress to pass one bill or another?
Well, there's been a lot of pressure, I mean, certainly from these agencies. And, there's been some really startling images and reports this past week and the week before. As you mentioned, as you heard from Senator Johnson during that hearing, there's this photo that lawmakers have been invoking. I think everyone's seen it. This very really harrowing photo of a father and his two-year-old daughter from El Salvador who drowned trying to cross the river. And several, lawmakers have said this they don't want to see a photo like this. You've heard lawmakers on both sides of the aisle saying, okay, we need to do something. This photo really epitomizes this crisis. And at the same time, we've been hearing from lawyers who have gotten access to Border Patrol facilities, most notably one recently in Texas, where Border Patrol has been holding hundreds of children, some of them very young, without their parents, in pretty squalid conditions, according to the lawyers. And so that also really galvanized people on both sides of the aisle saying, okay, we need to do something. This is not sustainable. Children cannot be held this way. And obviously, though, there were party divisions over, what to do next and how to solve this problem.
Yeah, and what have we been hearing from Democrats so far? I would imagine that Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi was sort of in this unenviable situation where you've got kind of two wings of the party wanting two different things. What kind of things are we hearing from Democrats reacting to the passage of this?
Well, I think you have a lot of very liberal Democrats, on the left who are saying, no, we should not have settled for the Senate bill, which, ultimately does not include what House Democrats wanted, which was, provisions that would, for example, limit children's stays in some of these children's shelters to no more than 90 days, before they're reunited with a family member. They wanted Customs and Border Protection to set up these new health and safety standards, after learning that there are, children in custody who don't have access to soap, potentially, who, are really dirty, who aren't getting cared for, who are the little kids dependent on slightly older kids to take care of them. They felt like there needed to be provisions in this bill to make sure they felt that this money was being spent in an appropriate way and that there would be more accountability. Ultimately, they gave in to having just this broad spending package. And as you said, Nancy Pelosi probably was not in this in an enviable position, having to sort of mediate between moderates and liberals in the party to ultimately get this bill through.
We're talking with Abigail Hauslohner. She's an immigration reporter with The Washington Post, and we are talking about the humanitarian aid package passed by now by both the House and the Senate. The House opting to go with the Senate's plan, which had fewer provisions into oversight and other things like that. And Abigail, one of the other things I think was the difference between the House version of the plan and the Senate version of the plan was how much advance notice agencies down there would need to have if, let's say, a lawmaker wanted to come and visit and see the conditions at one of these facilities. Can you talk about what the difference was there between those two plans?
Right. Well, lawmakers, journalists, lawyers to some extent as well, people have complained about a real lack of transparency. That's been part of one of the big issues here. It's been very difficult, not just for journalists, but lawmakers, as you mentioned, to get information, to get access to Border Patrol facilities and Health and Human Services facilities to actually see the conditions that children are being held in and adults. And so that was a major issue. Lawmakers want to be able to hold these agencies accountable. Democrats want to be able to get down there to the border and walk into these facilities and see for themselves. I think there was a lot of frustration you know, that people were hearing. For example, we all learned of the situation in this facility in Clint, Texas, from a handful of lawyers who visited as monitors and interviewed the children. Otherwise, you know, critics are saying we might not have known for weeks, months.
One of the things that I think I remember reading about the differences between the House and the initial Senate version was that with the Senate plan, there was going to be money set aside going towards the military. Was there some concern from House Democrats over how that funding might actually be used?
Right. Well, some there has been talk and there are plans to set up new shelters, basically expand the bed space for child migrants in detention on military bases. You know, that's not unprecedented. That's been done in the past, certainly under the Obama administration as well. But, you know, House Democrats in Congress are certainly very wary of how that money is being used. They don't want to further sort of get the military involved. They don't want to expand the detention space and are thereby the detention of minors and others who ultimately they think should not be in custody.
We're talking about the border aid package that passed the Senate and the House with Abigail Hausloner. She covers immigration for The Washington Post.
You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Let us know what you think about the situation on the southern border. What do you make of the drama that unfolded in Congress this week over the humanitarian aid package? What kind of aid do you think should have gone to the border? What do you think the Trump administration should do to mitigate the crisis? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the humanitarian crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border and the aid package that Congress just passed to address it. Abigail Hausloner is our guest. She's an immigration reporter with The Washington Post.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about how Congress handled the emergency aid situation? What questions do you have about what's in the legislation? And how would you like to see immigration tackled going forward? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. And we are going to go to the phones now. We've got Brenda, who's with us in Spring Green. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm trying to talk about a more holistic and kind of going forward idea. I'm just not certain why this package or any of the conversations that I'm privy to or understanding why the communities in Wisconsin and across the country are looking for workers. We are desperate in our town to have people here to do the jobs. Businesses are have to close on days of business because we can't find workers, and why this is not attached to this idea of the immigration issue that's happening when people are desperate to come for work. And I just never hear that conversation in any of these discussions in the legislative level.
Brenda, thank you so much for that call. And Brenda's saying there needs to be, in any bill, some kind of road for citizenship. And that's something that some Democrats have wanted for a long time. In an emergency aid bill, there may not have been time for that. But how do you see Democrats latching onto this idea of a road to citizenship as part of a broader reform package, Abigail?
Well, that's certainly something. I mean, what Brenda mentioned, obviously, is there are lots of facets to this major ongoing debate about immigration reform. One of them is, you know, worker visas that would bring in temporary workers for seasonal jobs on farms and factories and so on, as well as, you know, more permanent workers, more immigrants. The administration has tried to sort of really limit the flow of immigrants and has proposed measures that would fundamentally alter, you know, what types of immigrants are allowed in. Now, that's somewhat separate from what's going, although, you know, somewhat separate from what's being debated and the bill that was passed in regards to the border. This bill that was just passed that the president is likely to sign deals pretty exclusively with a humanitarian crisis and sort of a logistical crisis that a group of government agencies are facing in trying to deal with hundreds of thousands of mostly Central American migrants coming across the border and detaining them and putting them through the system and trying to figure out what to do with them. Now, obviously, a lot of those people, you know, are coming for, presumably, most of those migrants are coming for in search of a better life. A lot of people are fleeing violence or they're fleeing poverty. And, you know, jobs in the United States are certainly, I think, one of the appeals. Certainly Republicans would say so. I'm certain many of the migrants would, too. But as Brenda's probably aware, jobs and the idea of immigrants being competition to American native-born Americans for jobs is part of the debate. It's certainly one of the Republican talking points. One of the Republican arguments is that, well, Americans should be getting these jobs. And so that's also another reason why immigrants should not be allowed in. And in terms of those coming across the southern border, what we're dealing with is, you know, a crisis of, as the government says, unauthorized immigration. These are people who are claiming asylum, these are people who are crossing the border illegally, being apprehended by Border Patrol, often claiming asylum. It's not the same thing as folks who are applying for work visas.
Brenda, thank you so much for that call. Abigail, what has President Trump said about everything that's happened this week with the humanitarian aid bills, the competing bills that were making their way through Congress?
Well, Trump has, you know, the White House has supports the Senate bill. Now that it's been passed by the House, he's expected to sign it. He has commented briefly on the situation on the border and says, you know, has echoed other officials saying, you know, it's not good. He doesn't. It needs to be fixed, but has also cast blame on to Democrats for holding up the process and for creating the crisis by not agreeing or going along with efforts, his administration's efforts towards immigration reform. He also said earlier this week that even though the crisis is bad, it was still worse under President Obama.
And briefly, as we begin to wrap up, Abigail, we've got the second of two Democratic presidential debates tonight. Do you expect that this is going to be a hot topic of discussion when those 10 candidates take the stage?
I think if last night was any indicator, it certainly will be. Immigration is, you know, it took center stage last night with Joaquin Castro, you know, basically challenging other candidates to weigh in on his sort of radical proposal to eliminate the criminality of crossing the border as a non-citizen. And I would imagine that the candidates are going to get some very pointed questions on that tonight as well.
Well, Abigail, thank you so much for joining us today and bringing us up to speed.
My pleasure.
Abigail Hauslohner is an immigration reporter with The Washington Post, and we talked with her about the border aid package that passed Congress just this afternoon to address the humanitarian crisis at the southern border. It now heads to President Trump's desk.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk summer vegetables, from tomatoes, zucchini, and everything in between. It's Food Friday on Central Time.
We'll recap both the Democratic presidential debates. We had one last night. We're going to have another one tonight. And we'll hear what the candidates had to say on issues such as climate change, gun control, immigration, and much more.
And, of course, we'll take a closer look at today's two big rulings from the Supreme Court on gerrymandering and a citizenship census question. That's coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.
And plenty of time to share your opinion. Just send us a tweet at Central Time WPR.